Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, a conversation about what's happening in the world and what it means from global business. From the studios of Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy on the south bank of the River Thames in London. I'm Charles Hecker, senior partner. The Risk Map Podcast will travel around the world to discuss some of the most pressing, most relevant, and most interesting issues in risk. We'll start the tour in the Americas, but not really to talk about geography. This time our focus is on natural disasters, hurricanes in the Caribbean and the United States, and the deadly earthquake in Mexico City. Rebecca Scorzato in our Washington office is a specialist in crisis response and business continuity, and she's got a few things to say about preparing for and bouncing back from major natural disasters. After that, we're headed to Africa and a discussion of the newly released Risk and Reward Index, produced by Control Risks and our joint venture partners, Oxford Economics. Finally, we'll talk about Catalonia and the attitude of the business community towards the Spanish province's independence referendum. My colleague Nick Paynes is just back from a few days in the Spanish capital, Madrid. But first, down to the rain-soaked and nervous climes of the southern United States, the Caribbean, and Mexico. It's not just the residents who are learning to live again after flooding, wind damage, and the collapse of the surrounding infrastructure. The business community, too, is wringing itself out, dusting itself off, and getting back to work. We're in Washington with Rebecca Scorzato. Rebecca is a partner and a specialist in disaster recovery, business continuity, and crisis management. Rebecca, welcome to the podcast. I think this is your first visit.
It is. Thank you so much for having me.
Rebecca, we've had a series of natural disasters around the world in recent weeks, not just the hurricanes in the United States, but also an earthquake in Mexico. And I think what we've learned from all of this is a number of companies were caught off guard. As we look to the next round of natural disasters, whenever and wherever they may be, to respond and recover, what is the most central plan an organization needs to have in place?
Yeah, so I think this is a natural disaster scenario is really the classic planning scenario for a business continuity plan. And what we've seen in these recent disasters is really putting organizations' tactical business continuity plans to a test. And you know, for businesses that are in locations that are prone to natural disasters, such as in the Caribbean, the southeastern United States, Mexico City, of course, with the earthquakes they've experienced, a lot more attention is paid to these contingencies and tactical planning. However, one of the things that we've seen in organizations as they've responded, that some of the logistical and tactical elements of their business continuity plans weren't quite as up to date as they needed to be in order for them to be implemented effectively.
It's probably not surprising to learn that companies have disaster recovery plans. I'd hazard a bet that a lot of them are covered with a reasonably thick layer of dust. How do you overcome that reluctance to spend the time and maybe the money on disaster recovery planning when you're not sure when the next disaster is going to hit?
Yeah, so I think that in order for these plans to stay up to date, it's more of, we would say, the planning than the plan that, to your point, can be covered with dust. And the way that you do that is by running exercises of the plans on best practices on an annual basis. While you hope that you won't have a natural disaster every year, it's really critical to go through the organizational response to ensure that these plans are going to be adequate to meet your needs, you know, to ensure that your IT infrastructure is going to be able to support recovery at a remote location, ensure that your employee lists are up to date, to be able to overcome a lot of the challenges that we've seen organizations have in the past several weeks in this real tactical response to a situation.
Rebecca, when we see the pictures in the aftermath of something like Houston or Mexico City, we see pictures of property damage primarily, and then we see pictures of people. How does an organization support their employees and family members, their stakeholders, the people who are impacted by a natural disaster?
I think this is the most critical thing that an organization needs to be prepared to deal with in the aftermath of a natural disaster. Your people are really your most critical asset, and you need to focus on that really from the outset of the situation in your ability to resume business at some stage. To do that, we would recommend an organization's crisis management team, who would include HR as a key stakeholder, be meeting on a very regular basis in the lead up to and during and in the aftermath of a natural disaster. You should be thinking through your policies, such as, are we going to continue to pay our employees during the disaster? Is there any difference between hourly and salaried personnel? Are we going to provide a location for our employees to live if their homes are damaged or if they're displaced? A lot of organizations will offer 30 days of temporary housing. And then, if you're going to offer that, do you even know where to source that temporary housing? That could be a concern. And then another thing for organizations to think through is, how far do you want that duty of care to extend? Is that going to be just for the employee, for their immediate family, for their extended family? What is your line on that? And really, how can you support an employee during a very challenging time and resolve issues that they're having at the home so that they can at some point resume work? That could include anything from doing a damage assessment to their home to offering them rebuilding support to be able to move back into a property. So, a range of different support might be provided, and it's really important for you as an organization to agree on what that's going to be.
Rebecca, we've done a little bit about planning. We've done a little bit about immediate issues. At some point, a company is going to start to think about resuming operations. So, what comes into play at that point? What sort of considerations should be front of mind for a company when they want to get back up and running again?
Yeah, so I think the first point is really ensuring your people are able to come back to work. And as we talked about, that starts earlier than when you can think about resumption planning. The next thing is really having a thorough understanding of your facilities and conducting a thorough damage assessment to understand, technically, are you able to get back into this space? Have you assessed really the physical infrastructure there? You're going to want to have a review of your insurance coverage and looking at what might be covered from a business interruption perspective, from a property perspective, and also do a bit of a gap analysis if there's additional coverage you want to have moving forward. You're going to want to also have a review from a security perspective of your facility and also the area surrounding your facility. Areas that are impacted by natural disasters often are plagued by looting, and you want to make sure that you're sending your people into a sort of safe and secure environment before you resume operations. And that might also include offering your employees transport to the office, just ensuring that everything is safe and secure and really ready for your employees to be able to come back to business, to be able to focus on their jobs again and not be concerned about their well-being.
Rebecca, we still have a few more weeks to go in hurricane season. Thank you very, very much for this to-do list. Rebecca Scorzato in our Washington, D.C. office, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
With a name like Control Risks, it tends to be an occupational hazard to talk a lot about things that can go wrong. But we understand that the flip side of risk is opportunity and that the two are almost inseparable. We've gone to the African continent to look for the optimal blend of risk and reward. Paul Gabriel is our senior analyst for East Africa, and Paul was one of the primary authors behind the Africa Risk Reward Index. This is a publication recently released by Control Risks and our joint venture partner, Oxford Economics. It's something new for both of our companies because we toured the African continent and looked for the optimal combination of both risk but also reward to potential investors. Paul joins me in our studio here in London today. Paul, there's a little bit of science behind this publication. Take us briefly, if you can, through the methodology behind the risk-reward index.
Thank you, Charles. So the risk and reward index is combining quantification of both the risk and the reward side. And specifically at the risk side, which we are very familiar with, we looked at risks across a different set of categories. We looked at political risk, such as political stability. We looked at economic risks, such as economic growth forecasts for the coming years, the structure of the economies. And we combined those two in one index to look at the balance between the two, which is really interesting because investors will know that you can hardly find reward anywhere without also taking the risks.
Paul, almost anybody with a laptop and a printer can publish an index, and lots of people do. And there are all sorts of indices about risk and about investment in Africa. You read lots of them all the time. What makes this index a little bit different?
I think what's really special and different about this index is that it really combines these two sides. So yes, you do find plenty of indices that look at risk and solely risk. And so they might look at political stability, they might look at conflict levels and similar things. You might also find various indices that look at investment opportunities, such as forecasts for GDP growth. But what you rarely find is an index that combines the two things together. Because as I said, investors will know that they have to take a certain amount of risk to also find the reward. But it's often difficult to find out which are the countries where that balance is right, where if you do take the risk, there's also plenty of opportunity for you to be rewarded for doing so.
Paul, finally, why don't you take us on a brief tour? Where did you find the most interesting combinations or the most attractive combinations of risk and reward?
So for this index, for the first iteration, what we looked at were, of course, the big economies in Africa, the ones that you can't overlook. And in particular, we looked at South Africa, we looked at Nigeria, and we looked at Egypt. But what's interesting is that most of these, actually all of these countries, currently are struggling a little bit. Nigeria has its fair share of issues with the low price of oil. South Africa has challenges around the political risk, and Egypt still has challenges around security. So although these are very big economies, the balance between risk and reward isn't exactly optimal there at the moment. What we found, however, was that if you look a bit further east and amongst the countries like Kenya and Ethiopia, the balance looks much more favorable. And that's on the one hand side, yeah, these countries do still present a fair amount of risk. If you just look at Kenya and the challenges around rerunning the presidential election at the moment, or Ethiopia, which had almost 2 years of social unrest. But at the same time, the economies there are also very interesting because they're highly diversified and strong across a number of sectors, and investors who are willing to take the risks and going into those countries can be fairly sure to also be rewarded there.
Paul Gabriel, thanks very much. The Africa Risk Reward Index is available on the websites of both Control Risks and Oxford Economics. That's at controlrisks.com and oxfordeconomics.com. Thanks, Paul. Finally, Spain, or more specifically Catalonia, scene of an incredibly contentious independence movement and its anticipated an illegal referendum on separation. I'm joined in our London studio today by Nick Paines. Nick is a newcomer to the Risk Map podcast. Nick, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Nick is also a newcomer to London, having just relocated from Mexico City, where he was our head of office, to becoming the head of our political risk consultancy for Europe and Africa. And one of Nick's inaugural business trips was to the Spanish capital, Madrid. Nick, you're just back. I can't imagine that Catalonia did not come up when you're sitting in meeting rooms across Madrid.
It was the topic of the day. On one level, it was a lovely time to visit the capital of Spain, a late autumn sunshine. And the tourists seemed to be having a good time, but the reality was that every single newspaper on the front page, every single radio show and every single TV show was talking about the referendum, what could happen, what the implications of that were, and really it is the critical issue in Spain and would undoubtedly dominate everything as we build up to that 1st of October referendum.
What were business people saying, and what do they think is going to happen?
Understandably concerned. Most businesses have operations and interests across all of Spain, so therefore a material change in Catalonia has some very real and practical implications for their people and for their interests. And on one level, there is a rational argument that this will go in a certain direction and life will continue as normal. But there is an unpredictable and irrational component that is making people rather nervous. Some of that is fed by some of the national dialogues. Some of it is fed by the results that we've seen in other parts of the world over recent years that have made the predictability of some of these processes that much more complex and difficult to foresee. So I think
you wouldn't happen to be talking about a Trump victory in the US presidential elections or the Brexit victory in the referendum last year or anything like that, would you?
Potentially.
Yeah.
So on one level, when you speak with people, they see two realistic scenarios. I mean, arguably there could be four, but let's look at the two that people are looking primarily. The first is this referendum goes ahead, that there is a resounding vote for independence, but that is then used by the Catalan government to engineer and pressure greater benefits, greater autonomy, greater economic resources, and perhaps to push for an official referendum further down the track, which could have more wide-reaching implications, say 2019, 2020. But this is used as an exercise, as a referendum to push for that change and a change in the balance of the relationship with the national government. The second scenario, and this I think is where really a lot of the concern lies, is that the referendum goes ahead and there is a significant vote for independence and that the Catalan government then unilaterally calls for independence. Now, whilst there is a low probability of it, there is, again, in this slightly more unpredictable geopolitical environment, the possibility that they could go down this path. And the absence of clarity of what that would look like, what a plan would be, what the implications would be from a business, operational, regulatory, financial services perspective is understandably generating a lot of concern and unrest.
So once again, as in similar situations, it's lack of clarity and unpredictability. And I guess from what you're saying is that the Catalan government has not done that much advance work about issues that we encountered during the Scottish referendum. What would the currency be? What would the relationship with the European Union be? Will Catalonia have a foreign policy? Will it have domestic policies that are dramatically different from the Spanish government, other than things like language and culture and what have you? Has any of that been worked out at all?
In theory. But I think the absence of detail, the absence of a coherent plan, an absence, a sensation that beyond the 1st of October and the 48, 72 hours after that result, the sensation that there isn't a material structure and plan for what may come is what is driving concern. And as I say, the first scenario is the favored one, but it is based upon certain actors behaving in a rational manner. And I think the concern is that there are elements of this that are slightly more emotional and irrational.
Nick, finally on this, I mean, the situation in Spain appears, you know, even from this distance, to be pretty tense. And, you know, we've had talks about conflicts with who's running the police in Catalonia and with the potential sort of shutting down of polling stations and, you know, blockading people who want to go cast ballots. Typically, Catalan independence referendums have sort of lukewarm turnout and sort of lukewarm, you know, opinion. What Madrid has done is it sort of stoked the flames in Barcelona and around Catalonia. Is that not the case?
Yes, I think so. I think the national government has sought to either break or limit this particular referendum and the ability for it to be seen as a legitimate exercise. I think, and this will ultimately be the big question post the 1st of October. based upon the turnout. So how many people actually come and vote, and who are those people that come and vote? There is a sense that there will be a material turnout, but those people that do go to vote are those that are going to be pro-independence, and that by and large, those that are against independence will probably stay at home. So whilst it would not be a surprise to see a yes to independence vote that is quite high in from a percentage terms, I think there will be a fundamental question as to the overall legitimacy of this. And I think that is what the national government has sought to achieve from some of the tactics that they've engaged with over the last few weeks and months.
Nick, thank you very, very much. That is hugely helpful. This podcast will be released just around the time of the elections. So something tells me that we'll come back to this point in the very near future. But until then, welcome back to London.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us on the Risk Map podcast. Nick Payne, senior partner with me here in London.
Before we sign off, a brief list of issues and items on our mind. Tuesday, the 5th of October, marks the anniversary of the founding of Chile's ultra-leftist guerrilla group, the FRPL, in 1987. Propaganda protests are likely, and symbolic attacks on government facilities or security forces are also possible. Thursday, the 10th of October, brings presidential elections to Liberia. The first round of voting in the presidential poll is likely to be indecisive. On Sunday, the 15th of October, we have parliamentary elections in Austria. The right-wing, anti-mainstream Free Party of Austria is likely to win the most votes in the election, though is unlikely to win enough votes to form a government on its own. Also on the 15th of October, we have presidential elections in Kyrgyzstan. 12 candidates are participating in the presidential runoff, but only a few are actively campaigning and have any prospect of success. We'll be back in another 2 weeks with a fresh look at what's happening in the world and what it means for global business. Until then, find the Risk Map podcast on our website, controlrisks.com, on Podbean, and on iTunes. Don't forget to send us your feedback. Email us at podcast@controlrisks.com and we'll answer every email we receive. As ever, thanks for listening. This is Charles Hecker from the Control Risks Studios in London.